Good evening, everyone, and thanks so much for joining us at the Free Library of Philadelphia at Home. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Before we begin tonight's presentation, I wanted to point out a couple of useful features on your screen. You'll see there's a button below that suggests you buy a copy of our guest new book, The Uninhabitable Earth. The button links to the website of the Joseph Fox Bookshop. They will be happy to send a copy to you anywhere in the country. On screen, you'll also see the Ask a Question link, which you can use to ask a question, suggest a topic, or upvote a question by using the arrows in the left margin. It's now my pleasure to introduce our guests. A columnist and deputy editor at New York Magazine, David Wallace Wells has written extensively about the environment and the future of science, including a widely read 2017 article about worst-case climate change scenarios, which serves as the basis for his book, The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming, a number one New York Times bestseller, reviewed in the journal Nature as powerfully argued, a masterly analysis of why, with a world of solutions, we choose doom. The book has been called this generation's Silent Spring. David will be in conversation with Dr. Rachel Valletta, environmental scientist at the Franklin Institute and director of all climate change education and outreach programming there. Rachel and David, the screen is all yours.
Fantastic. Thanks very much, Andy. And thanks to everyone at home for joining us this evening. David, it's a real pleasure to join you digitally today. And let's jump right in. As we were mentioning in our talk beforehand, you really came on my radar with quite a splash with the 2017 eponymous New York Magazine article. And I'm hoping that you can tell us a little bit about your journey, not just the impetus in putting together that 2017 article, but the journey since then to leading up to writing this longer format book.
Absolutely. So thank you for having this conversation. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks to the library for having me. It's great to be here, even at a distance. I came to the subject primarily out of fear. I was somebody who, I'm a magazine journalist, general interest magazine journalist, who had a sort of special interest in science in the near future and sort of kept an eye on the news from the academy as a result, but wasn't at all a kind of climate activist. I had never spent any time in my life preoccupied with climate change as much as I knew it was real and knew it was something to be concerned about. It also felt like one of many challenges we had to face. And as a lifelong New Yorker, I also felt like I lived outside of nature and therefore it was something that was going to challenge and threaten primarily people living elsewhere on the planet. And while I was worried about their fates, it didn't feel intimate or immediate or personal to me. And that changed sort of gradually and then very suddenly in 2016. I just started seeing a lot more news from climate science. And that news was a lot scarier than I had seen it depicted in most mainstream publications, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post. When I watched cable news, it seemed like the news from science was painting a much, much bleaker picture than people like me, who are pretty informed, but not, you know, neck deep in the research as you are, would have appreciated. And that then sort of accelerated with a particular week in the fall of that year, when temperatures in the Arctic were, I think, 40 degrees warmer than they were supposed to be. And I knew enough about what's called runaway global warming, which is sort of what happened on Venus, we think, to worry that that was happening here, that the planet might very quickly destabilize its climate. And I looked into that and quickly realized that was not the case. Nobody's worried about that. But I had been tripped into a kind of a running panic attack. And as a result, sort of fell headlong into deeper and deeper research into the science itself. And what I saw there in almost every particular scared me a lot more than I had been before, but also started to showcase this story of climate change as a much bigger, more all-encompassing and epic drama than I'd really appreciated before. You know, I often say half of all the damage we've produced from the burning of fossil fuels in the history of humanity have come in the last 30 years. That's in my lifetime, which means my life contains the entire story of the destabilized planet. And now scientists say we have about 30 years to really take action. If we have a hope of meaningfully averting some of these truly scary scenarios, I'm likely to be alive for that whole story too. And so in the space of a single lifetime, we've really fundamentally changed the experience of life on this planet and everything about the future of humanity. How much that changes and how much we have to adapt, those are open questions, which we will be answering in the decades ahead. But just the sheer scale of that drama was really eye-opening and moving and terrifying to me. And I didn't see many other people in positions like mine, sort of general interest journalists, talking about climate change in those terms. They were often talked about it, you know, report by report, and they were very cautious to not really explore all that deeply or all that explicitly this sort of scarier end of what was possible if we didn't take action, because they thought it was really important to emphasize the optimistic end of the spectrum. And, you know, as someone who was really woken up by fear, I thought that there was a big story to tell that was useful on its own terms as true, but also from a kind of an advocacy perspective, that there were probably people like me who were ready to be drawn into climate engagement through fear, but who hadn't seen the story told that way before. And so I wrote the story that you mentioned in 2017, which was focused explicitly on worst case scenarios. And it was a huge deal. It was for a while the most widely read story New York Magazine had ever published. It's no longer that, but it was for a while. And because it was so widely read, it sort of threw me into a series of conversations and debates with climate scientists, climate activists, climate journalists about, you know, first, sort of briefly, it was about whether the science in the story was accurate, because it struck a lot of people as, you know, people had seen a lot of the science before. But we sort of quickly published a fully annotated version that I think basically answered that charge. And then a more protracted and I think more worthy conversation about whether it was responsible and then productive to talk about climate change in these terms, whether being an alarmist was useful or counterproductive. And I felt even more having engaged in those conversations that there was value to it. I thought a bit more about the history of environmental activism, what had worked in the past. I thought and read through the behavioral psychology about some of these questions. And I also just sort of did some common sense reflecting, because when I look out at the world still today with concern about climate change rising very rapidly, I still see so many more people by orders of magnitude who are not concerned enough about this than people who are maybe on the brink of being so freaked out that they're turning off. And for all those reasons, I thought that I wanted to sort of extend the project that I had initiated in the book and be really clear about just how dramatic the transformations we're likely to see this century are, and just how fundamentally they're going to shape just about every aspect of human life on the planet. And that's, you know, to me, ultimately the subject of the book, and I think something we haven't collectively started to really think about our process all that well, in part because we've been so focused on the science, we haven't done enough to really think about the implications beyond the science for what it would mean for the planet to change in these profound ways, what it would mean for our politics and our culture, our psychology, our relationship to nature and to history and all that. And I think that's sort of the second half of the book, or the final third or whatever. And I think that's ultimately a kind of more, you know, original contribution to the conversation than even, sure. Even though the book has been processed primarily as a kind of work about the state of the science, which is quite alarming.
Yeah, and I'd like to jump in there, because on all accounts, it is very well cited. And I think that you certainly addressed some of those concerns perhaps that folks had of the 2017 piece initially. But I do completely agree with you that your unique contribution is that second portion of the book. What you do so eloquently in the book, I find, is making the numbers and making the hard science relatable to us, right? And I think that's something that we are challenged with as scientists, and perhaps one of the reasons that we've fallen into this pitfall of erring on the side of caution and only addressing optimistic scenarios. It's because we're not necessarily in the business of human storytelling. But as you say, you've utilized your platform quite successfully to do exactly that. So I do have to say that I commend you on that measure. I want to pick up on something that you mentioned in your response there, and you've spoken a lot about previously, and it's this idea of living outside nature. And so I don't want to, you know, jump too deeply down a philosophical rabbit hole here. We could certainly be here all evening. But, you know, there's this dichotomy that you sort of seem to draw in the text. And I don't know if it truly reflects your belief on where humans fit within nature. You suggest that we are surrounded by it or we are adjacent to it. Sometimes you even go so far as to suggest that the earth is an adversary and we need to go to war with it. But never going so far as to say that in addressing environmental issues, we're also sort of addressing our own issues, I suppose. So how do you sort of see that that dichotomy? Am I reading too much into it?
Well, for me, it's really important. And I think that's, you know, it's a story. Really, what you're pointing to is the story of my own awakening, which is to say that for most of my life, I really did feel like I lived outside of nature, and that the natural world was, you know, present to a certain degree in my experience and the experience of most people living in the sort of modern West, but that it didn't define us or shape our lives in a profound way. It was like decoration. And that we had over centuries, especially in the West, risen up from a kind of complicated mutual codependency to a position of dominion over the natural world. We could extract prosperity from it and visit it on vacation, but that it wasn't really tied up in who we were or what our lives would be. And that's really how I felt about things until I started freaking out about climate change. And I think one of the major lessons of climate change, I think it's also one of the major lessons of the pandemic that we're living through now, is that, of course, we don't live outside the bounds of nature. We live subject to its whims, sometimes subject to its brutality. And we are living in... you know, that's not to say I wouldn't describe that relationship as primarily adversarial, but it can be made that way if we behave in certain ways and take certain actions, which we have been doing now for, depending on how you want to count, a couple of centuries or a couple of decades, with, you know, producing so much carbon that the planet doesn't really know what to do with it. A sort of happier outcome would be one in which we fall into a more mutually beneficial, supportive, codependent relationship. And I think there's some reason to think that we are moving in that direction, but I worry that it's, you know, sort of too little too late to find a soft landing in a climate like the one that we become accustomed to as a species. You know, there was a paper just out yesterday projecting temperatures over the next 60 years up to 2070. And the headline finding was, you know, first of all, they looked back through history and found that humans have really only been comfortable living in a quite narrow, what they call climate niche, that there's a pretty narrow band of temperatures that we're comfortable living in. We've never really lived outside of those boundaries as a species. And by 2070, the headline finding was 3.5 billion humans will be living in places that are outside of that climate niche. Now, that requires a kind of high-end emissions trajectory, which is probably higher than we're likely to see. But even in a completely optimistic, where we do the best that we can and keep warming to about 2 degrees scenario, still about 1.5 billion people would be living in places that, according to the history of humanity, are literally uninhabitable. And, you know, I think sometimes when we talk about these futures, we undersell how adaptive we are, how resilient we are as a species. I think we are both of those things, and we will find ways to live in a much more hostile planet. But 1.5 billion people is an enormous amount of people, and many of those areas are going to be really punishingly uncomfortable quite soon. And I think that that is, for me, the one of the really big picture, important, really big picture perspectives to assume, to try to wrap your head around if you can. Everything that we've ever known as a species is the result of climate conditions which we have already left behind. So the sort of evolution of the human animal, the development of rudimentary civilization and agriculture and modern civilization, everything we've ever known of ourselves as social creatures, political creatures, cultural creatures, all of that was produced by climate conditions which we've already left behind, and now we're living on functionally a different planet with different rules. And we're beginning to see what that is going to look like, but we're only just beginning. And if we assume that the conditions that we have today at just 1.1 degrees of warming are going to continue in a protracted way to allow us to adjust to things like the Australia wildfires or the unprecedented flooding in the Midwest, that's really foolish, because the next decades are going to contain considerably more warming. It's up to us how much, to some degree, but almost inevitably we're going to get some. And so the world is going to change even from here, making it considerably less hospitable and more comfortable, and maybe even beyond questions of hospitability and comfort, less familiar. It's just going to be a different world, quite in a lot of ways, quite radically different from the one that produced the rise of humans in the first place.
Yeah, it's so sobering. And yet as you're speaking there, I'm thinking about how challenging it is for us, and indeed near impossible for humans, to connect with orders of magnitude beyond our own human experiences. There's been an interesting research endeavor into this exactly. We can't understand the nanoscale. We can't understand geologic time. It's something that I struggle with, certainly in the climate education space, and it sounds like that's something that you've struggled with as well. How do you deal with time in that regard when we talk about human civilization tens of thousands of years, when we talk about the survival of our species hundreds of thousands of years, the evolution rather of our species? It seems so long, and yet in the blink of an eye we've made big changes. Even that seems, I guess, challenging to contextualize. So how do you deal with orders of magnitude and scaling in that regard?
Well, the way that I think of that particular question is that we are living in a kind of a theological time.
Say more.
And that, that's a term that makes me uncomfortable. I don't like, I'm not like a believing person. I think it can be a little grandiose to talk in those terms. But when you really reckon with the fact that in the space of a single generation, we've done enough damage to the planet to call into question its habitability for the future of humanity. I don't think the planet's going to make humans extinct or anything like it, but it has drawn that possibility into the realm of the possible. In the space of a single generation, and in the space of a single generation, we now have the responsibility to stabilize that climate so future generations can not just continue to live, but ideally continue to live in a relatively prosperous, relatively comfortable, relatively just world. That is an unbelievable drama that you and I and everyone alive on the planet today is living through. And it's true that what is happening is that we are compressing what is typically in planetary history a process of millions of years and going through it in the space of a century or two. But you don't even really need to think of it in terms of millions of years. You just have to think of it as like, this is the all time that we're living through right now. This is a generation in which we are navigating a hinge point in the history of the species, and actions that we take today are going to determine not just the lives of our children and grandchildren, but to a certain degree, the lives of every human who ever lives ever again. So that sense of an eternal present, or everything that we've ever done as a species taking place right now, I think is, at least that's how I see my way through the complications of timescale. And I also think it's, to get back to something I was talking about a little bit about before, it's one aspect of how I see this story as a just grand, epic, historical narrative, in addition to being a tragedy and an outrage, and a scientific puzzle and a technological puzzle and a political puzzle. In addition to all of that, it's just such a big story that we're living through. And each of us, not just as observers, but because we are political actors, as protagonists, which I think is ultimately, despite this sort of bleak and terrifying world depicted in a lot of my book, ultimately it's a kind of an empowering message, because all of the things that we're talking about being scared of, all of the climate outcomes we're talking about really being scared of, you know, hundreds of millions of climate refugees, hundreds of millions of people dying from air pollution, you know, the end of Arctic and Antarctic ice sheets, which could ultimately bring 250 feet of sea level rise, and all the rest of the scary things coming down the line. All of those things are only happening and will only happen if we choose to make them happen. We are writing that story. We are at the moment continuing to choose to write a really bleak story. But while there are huge political and social obstacles to it, we can also theoretically write a different story. And, you know, feeling like protagonists in that decision-making process is a really empowering, eye-opening, exhilarating experience. And, you know, ultimately, that's what I say whenever people come to me and ask questions like yours, or maybe even more to the point, like, what can I do? This problem seems so big. Whenever, the more I read, the more overwhelmed I am. I mean, it is obviously overwhelming, but it's also, you know, that feeling of being overwhelmed is in a certain way a call to action.
Right.
And, you know, I've felt that myself as a writer. I'm not temperamentally someone who is an activist or a joiner. I still feel weird playing even that role in a hybrid, to a hybrid degree. But I also think that this crisis is too big a challenge for us to depend solely on the people who are temperamentally activists.
Yes.
We need a lot more people like me who, in an ideal world, wouldn't have anything to do with this fight. Nevertheless, feeling so moved and so drawn in that they are, that they become activists. And as a result, I think we also need a kind of advocacy community, an activist community, that doesn't draw such bright lines, that pushes people like me away and says, okay, even if you are not a lifelong environmentalist, even if you don't want to become a vegan and never get on a plane again, like, you still have a home in this movement, because the stakes are so big that we need every person we can get to make the changes that scientists say we need.
Yeah, I love that commentary, and I think it is so spot on. And I'd like to pivot to another section in the book where that comes up. Before I do, I'll just remind our audience that you can ask a question to us, and you can upvote existing questions. So as we work into our Q&A in just a few minutes here, we'll start with those most highly voted questions. So, David, I want to go back then to that idea of an inclusive environmental left, or I say environmental left, but you said they're advocacy, and we shouldn't assume any kind of party affiliation here. So that's an important note. I will say I was a little bit surprised to see the critique so widely distributed in the book to different political actors, including and perhaps especially so the environmental left. And I have to admit, there was this moment of sort of getting through that prickly response first. But then recognizing that what you're arguing is completely valid, and perhaps more important than turning to critiquing known enemies, if you like, known adversaries. And so what you're arguing is that the environmental left is just as much responsible as those larger actors, like political parties and institutions. Can you speak a bit to why you believe that is, and for perhaps some of the advocacy crowd here, about how we can start bringing in voices like yours that are inviting critique, which we should be doing to better our own efforts?
Well, I would say I would quibble a little bit with the way that you presented my perspective, in the sense that there are degrees of responsibility here. And it is certainly the case that the fossil fuel companies and their friends in powerful positions in government throughout the world are villains beyond anything that, you know, the layperson ever approaches in their daily life. And while I think there have been some sort of unfortunate, complicating messaging coming from the environmental movement. I basically think of it as a heroic project, which is now really making, I think, some quite vivid, inarguable progress on this absolutely essential issue. So I don't want to say, like, you know, I don't want to be seen in any ways vilifying environmentalists, but I do think that we have a tendency, especially in countries like the US, to want to point fingers at villains rather than understand the degree to which we are complicit in systems that are that we wish to see changed. And the truth is, while, for instance, you know, climate denial in the US is horrifying, it's a moral and an intellectual horror, it isn't really mirrored much anywhere else in the world. Yeah. And nowhere else in the world is all that much more progressive on climate than the US is. There are certain countries who are doing a little bit better. There are a lot of countries who talk a much better game than the US does. But in terms of, you know, bending the curve of emissions downward, you're really talking about a handful of countries, and that's it. Now, I think the US has a special responsibility on the global stage because we are responsible for the world's, for the, you know, the lion's share of historical emissions. We are still the world's biggest economy. I don't want to diminish American responsibility either. But I think, you know, to anyone who thinks, okay, 70% of emissions come from these 50 companies or whatever the stat is, if we just like abolished Exxon tomorrow, there would be an enormous amount of suffering and outrage, even among a lot of people who consider themselves environmentalists in the US. We benefit enormously from the prosperity that has been produced from the burning of fossil fuels. Some of that prosperity is only being extended, you know, in the last few decades to parts of the developing world and only just beginning to be. And I think we can, you know, we can, I do think of myself as a member of the environmental left. As a part of that movement, I think we can fall into a trap where we think we should just like wipe the stage of those villains and then we'll be in perfectly good shape. And, you know, there's part of me that thinks that too. We are subsidizing fossil fuel businesses. We certainly shouldn't be doing that. But it takes large scale systematic efforts to change things for instance, a new electric grid to be built, or, you know, new fuel efficiency standards or requirements for new charging stations for your Tesla, or to have a whole new fleet of airplanes developed that can fly on zero carbon fuel, or to have a new way of raising animal proteins so that we don't have to ask every single person on the planet to go vegan to avoid the carbon emissions produced from animal agriculture. And all of those require large, you know, real political commitments. They're too big to be solved through individual action. And I think there is a tendency, not just on the left and not just in America, but maybe most dramatically on the American left, to believe that we make our political mark on the world through what we buy and what we consume as individuals, rather than to see, you know, the major mark is being made through politics. And I do think that, you know, I hear from a lot of people after speeches, after panels, letters, you know, emails, people whose first and main question to me is like, what can I do to live a more climate responsible life? And I basically think that that question is backwards, that if you are committed to climate action in your political life, it actually can excuse a lot of bad behavior in your individual life, which probably you're not going to be that excited to give up anyway. I think there's some value in taking individual measures. It signals to politicians and to other people that you're concerned. But on just judging concretely, the impacts are much, much greater through large-scale political action. Mm-hmm. And I think as a result, we need many more people to want to vote for radical climate change and support politicians who support that. And we need probably fewer people who think, oh, okay, I bought a Tesla and therefore I'm a climate saint and I don't need to worry about doing anything else. Because that kind of action, while laudable, you know, we should all be driving electric cars. We should all never set a foot on an airplane again. Is trivial. compared to the kinds of changes that we need, which we can only bring about through large-scale collective action. And that requires compromise with people who are, you know, less extreme on the spectrum than we may be. Mm-hmm. And on top of all that, you know, I think there's a kind of natural psychological tendency for anyone engaged in any movement to think that, like, they're doing enough. And I think the science tells us that, practically speaking, all of us on the planet are still living in denial, that we are not orienting our lives enough, or especially our politics enough, around the principle of climate change. Mm-hmm. And maybe as a result, we should be a little less angry or dismissive of people who are maybe a little more in denial than we are. Because, you know, aside from maybe Greta, there's basically nobody who's really living the truth of climate science to the degree that we need the whole world to be living it relatively soon.
Yeah. Yeah. And for those of us that aren't familiar, referring there to Greta Thunberg, a Swedish climate activist who's made quite a splash, certainly, on the international stage, addressing the UN, among a number of other governmental bodies, on the issue of climate change. So that brings us to just about 30 minutes here. So I'm going to transfer over and take some of our audience questions. And I'll start with the one that has the most votes. Says, David, I apologize, I haven't read the book. So if you've answered this question, apologies. The major population centers of China and India, over 2 billion people, are coming online using fossil fuels. These societies will drive most carbon emissions over the next decades. How do you see these societies engaging in climate change amelioration?
Well, it's a really important point. It's another bit of the kind of American narcissism, that we often think that the whole story is being written by the Republican Party here. And the truth is that what happens in Beijing, really primarily, but to a lesser extent, what happens in India and sub-Saharan Africa over the course of the rest of the century is going to determine the story much more profoundly than what happens in the US or Western Europe. In general, I would say that China is a real mixed bag. They've been investing quite dramatically in renewable technology, renewable energy. In fact, their rollout of new capacity puts the rest of the world to shame. They've been doing much more of it. But they've also continued to expand their coal-fired power and have a kind of mixed record on environmental regulations generally, such that they often roll back whatever protections they've put into place whenever they need a kind of an economic stimulus. They've already said that they're going to be doing this, and sort of already have done this, in response to the pandemic economic collapse that they had earlier this year. And we're doing the same in the US. We've announced, the EPA has announced, that it's basically not going to be monitoring anybody for anything for the foreseeable future. They're relying on companies, industries, to self-report their own levels of pollution, which is obviously a recipe for total disaster. But I think it's also possible that approach gets picked up elsewhere around the world as everybody's desperate to stimulate their economies quite quickly. India has, is farther behind, but they're also farther behind on the sort of development curve. There are a lot of people in India who are still burning wood in their homes, and that's really problematic. That's even sort of like before you get to coal, you're burning wood. But they're also pouring an enormous amount of money into renewable energy capacity, and that's encouraging. I think big picture, it's really important to understand that while it would have seemed impossible to believe just a decade or so ago, renewable energy is now cheaper in most parts of the world than dirty energy. In fact, a study came out last week that said that in 60% of the world, building new renewable capacity is cheaper than running old dirty infrastructure. So even if you have a coal plant, it's still cheaper to build a solar power plant instead going forward. And that's a kind of a unignorable economic logic that I think will drive quite a bit of change, at least in the electricity power sector going forward. The question is, will that change come fast enough? And more importantly, how quickly will it displace the existing dirty energy capacity we have? Because We've seen this incredible fall in prices. We've seen renewable energy be getting incredibly cheap. But we've basically just, rather than like retiring our dirty energy capacity, we've just added to our total pie. And that means while we have a lot more wind and solar than we had a decade ago, the actual proportion has not grown at all. And that means that we're actually relying on more dirty energy, even as we're expanding our renewable capacity. So these are all really important, big, open questions. And in particular, I think that the posture approach taken by Xi Jinping in Beijing is, you know, the determinative, if you had to find one, it's the thing that will determine the future of climate. It's crazy to think that it hangs on sort of one man who's in a kind of an authoritarian position. But practically speaking, it does, because he's likely to be in power for at least the next decade. And that decade will be absolutely critical. So I would like to see a lot more from China, a lot more climate leadership from China. There's some signs that as Donald Trump has been in office, they've been kind of geopolitical opportunity in presenting themselves more as a climate leader. But it's a little bit of a, like, they are talking that talk, but they're not quite walking the walk that you'd want to see. And what happens after the coronavirus, I think, is another, you know, a major question, which throws just about everybody's expectations for the future. My expectations were already pretty grim, but it throws all those expectations into question again.
Yeah, underscoring all of the unknowns there, and certainly in the abdication of U.S. leadership on the international stage, we've seen that growth of China into that space. So yet another unknown is how U.S. politics will affect that gameplay moving forward. And that brings us actually nicely to the next question I'd like to point out. And it's one, David, that you and I spoke about briefly before we began tonight. This question is from Justin. I worry very much that our systems of government are not set up for radical, unified change. However, the sudden, expansive response to COVID-19, as inefficient as it has been, gives me hope. How can we build from this moment while at the same time conditions make traditional forms of massive public protest nearly impossible? And I'll use my facilitator's prerogative there to add on how we can also connect to this idea of a global order that you speak to in the book, David.
It's a really great question. You know, when I look at what's happening around the world, I have two kind of contradictory responses. The first is, honestly, my breath is kind of taken away by the amount of action that has been taken in such a relatively short amount of time. If you had told me in November, or if you had asked me in November, if any kind of threat of any kind would prompt, you know, hundreds of millions of Americans and billions of people all around that northern hemisphere, now in the southern hemisphere too, to willingly suspend their social, financial, political lives for the sake of one another and their shared health, I would have thought that was impossible to believe. You know, it's especially dramatic to me in the U.S. given the values that we have as a country. But it really would have been hard for me to believe taking place anywhere in the world. And these shutdowns are taking place everywhere. We're willingly, to some degree, comfortably accepting a situation, you know, a kind of a set of conditions which are going to be punishing by just about every metric. Some people will be punished harder than others, as is the case with climate change. But no one is going to be unpunished by these experiences, by this experience. And yet there are very few people who are even really pushing back against it. We've seen over the last couple of weeks some small-scale protests in the U.S., but the polling is really quite clear that even the lion's share of Republicans are supportive of continued lockdowns. This is incredible to me. On top of all that, you've got, you know, a whole new spectrum of political possibility opened up. In 2009, we passed the stimulus bill to help recover from the Great Recession. That was considered unfathomably large at the time, so large that it, to a certain degree, spurred the rise of the Tea Party and the sort of backlash politics and deficit concern trolling that dominated for most of the Obama administration. We've already passed a stimulus that's three times that size, and we're going to be passing more. And assuming that, you know, Joe Biden and the Democrats, you know, get into the White House in November, which I think is a pretty safe assumption at this point. We're probably going to be, yeah, for sure. But I do think it's pretty safe. We're going to be doing a lot more then too, which means we've already, like, just judging by the size of the purse, we are spending much, much more aggressively than we would have thought was conceivable even a decade ago. And we've engineered that response in the space of just a few months. The particulars are even more eye-opening. You know, Republicans talking seriously about a UBI, universal basic income, talking about taking ownership stakes in airlines in, you know, in exchange for bailout money. This is would have been considered totally anathema to Republicans a year ago. And you've seen similar opening of the political aperture elsewhere around the world as well. In Denmark, they're paying 80% of everybody's wages for the foreseeable future. 80% of people's pay is coming from the government. And that's actually been cited as a model by a lot of other countries who are trying to make similar gestures. There's a couple of bills in the US that are trying to do that. Well, it's not going to happen, I would guess. When you look at all that, you think, okay, things that used to seem unmovable, unchangeable, the permanent features of our political landscape have shifted dramatically in the space of 6 months because of the perception of an imminent threat. Climate change could follow that track, especially if we became more clear-eyed about just what kind of threat we were facing. Now, there are differences. This has arrived. I talk a lot about how fast climate change has arrived. This has arrived much faster than climate change. It's taken us much more by surprise. And there's a very direct, like, I may die sense of dealing with a pandemic, which is not exactly how most people think about climate change, although I think they should think of it in those terms a little bit more. But nevertheless, it's quite encouraging. There's also been, you know, this isn't coordinated. There was no single international body that said we have to do this. The WHO has actually really stumbled and fell apart on the job. The UN has given basically no leadership. And both the US, which used to play a real leadership role, and Chinese governments have been terrible. And yet we have a truly coordinated global response of the kind like we need to deal with climate change. So even in the face of institutional failure, we have improvised a response quite like an organization, an institution would have designed if they were in power to design it. That's all really good. What I worry about is that this is an incredible, exhausting experience that we're going through, not just in this country, but in every single country in the world. We are exhausting ourselves emotionally, psychologically. I think we're also exhausting capital to the extent that that is a limited resource, where we may be exhausting political capital as well. And I worry that we'll come out of the other side of this, whenever that is. I think most people are underestimating how long this crisis will last. But even if we come out of it over the next 6 months, which I think would be really optimistic, we may just not have the appetite for a large scale investment program at the scale that we really need. And, you know, I might worry about that less if we had a little more time, if we had 5 decades instead of 3, or, you know, to really get a handle on this problem, or if we had 3 decades instead of 1 to cut it in half. You know, delaying by a couple of years and letting ourselves back on our feet might be even an option that I would choose. But the timeline is so short that we're already way behind the eight ball. And that means that we need to do everything we can as soon as we can, as ambitiously as we can. And I do worry that this process is going to drain some of our capacity for that, you know, major initiative, not just in the US, but all around the world.
I think that's really prescient, David. I mean, certainly we're independently feeling that exhaustion. I can pick it up in the tone of our voices, and many of our viewers, I'm sure, are feeling that as well. You know, I wonder, you mentioned there, I wrote down the I may die response to COVID, that we don't share that feeling about climate change. I wonder if unwelcomingly, we will feel that way this summer as we approach. I'm thinking about the 2020 hurricane season projections. We're looking at another likely pretty active hurricane season along the East Coast US, and this is hitting at a time when governmental resources and, as you say, independent resources are already stretched incredibly thin. You know, I wonder if we are hitting up against this harsh reality of climate change exacerbating some of those existing threats that we already feel, and as the hurricane season arrives at a time when we just don't have the capability to respond. So I suppose I'll leave that lingering there in the air as you know, perhaps we'll see that sooner rather than later.
Yeah, wildfire season too. I mean,
exactly.
It's particularly vivid to know that the thing that wildfire fighters wear to protect themselves against the smoke is an N95 mask, which have been, they were in short supply before COVID and they've become even in shorter supply now. And the people that we send out there to fight those fires are often in California felons who are making $1 a day or less. So we're throwing the weakest parts of our society, the most vulnerable parts of our society, in the face of rampaging disasters. We're doing that through housing policy and through, you know, abandoning them when they need it. But we're also doing it literally in the sense of fire, where we literally send felons into fires that, you know, Cal Fire has never, ever beaten a fire that was powered by Santa Ana winds. Like, they don't know how to change the direction of those fires. The best they can do is to hope to slightly, to sort of delay it until the winds die down. So these are really, you know, really horrific conditions that we're pushing the most vulnerable members of our society into. And that's a story that is everywhere you look on climate change.
Yeah, and forgive the unfortunate pun, but I caught my breath there as you said the N95 mask factoid. That's startling and sobering. I'd like to pivot to another audience question here. I think it's one that we've already addressed, but it's been upvoted a few times, so perhaps we can revisit it. And it's regarding the responsibility for preventing climate change. How much of the responsibility for preventing climate change do you believe belongs to individuals versus large corporations? So that's a bit of a recapitulation. But the next question I think is new for us. How much can personal austerity alleviate the problem of climate change when we live in an economy that thrives on consumption-based economic growth?
Well, it's a complicated tangle to untangle. I think that we're seeing now with COVID an illustration of the limits of personal austerity. You know, the estimates this year are that carbon emissions are going to decline by something like 5 to 8%. There's a bit of a range of estimates. Mm-hmm. Those are unprecedented declines, but they are insufficient to even get us to where we need to be in 2030 to have a reasonable chance of avoiding 2 degrees of warming, which is considered the threshold of catastrophe. That's because we would need to cut emissions by about 8% every single year between now and 2030 to give ourselves a decent chance to avoid that level of warming. And that means we would basically need a pandemic level reduction in personal consumption, personal travel, et cetera, in order to produce the level of carbon emissions reductions that we need. And I think that means that we need to do it some other way. And I think it has been a sort of sobering illustration of the limits of what some on the environmental left have called for a kind of degrowth approach to dealing with climate change, in the sense that we've essentially shut down our economy. In fact, most of the economies of the world have functionally cut their production by at least 20%, and in some cases considerably more. And we still haven't made that much of an impact on our carbon emissions. So if we have a hope of solving this problem simply through reducing our production and consumption, we're going to have to be reducing them quite dramatically in ways that I think would be a lot more painful than most of us would sign up for. And that means that, you know, what we need to do is to change the systems that produce those emissions and produce that prosperity for us. And luckily, that's not, you know, taken one by one, it's not that hard. We already talked about how the price differentials of renewable energy make it a really attractive replacement for dirty energy. You know, building a new electric grid would allow us to save 2/3 of the power that we put into it, because today 2/3 of the power that goes into the electric grid is wasted. We already know how to raise animal proteins in a way that turn them from cattle sources into carbon sinks through regenerative agriculture. and that sort of thing. We have these tools at hand. We just don't use them. We haven't put them into place. But even the large-scale systematic changes that we need to make, we know how to make them. Some of them are going to be a little more expensive than others, and in some cases, we could use some technological innovation to bring those prices down. But it's not like a mystery, with the possible exception of air travel, which I think we do need to figure out a kind of major breakthrough for. But I think that, you know, given all that, and given above all that in order to stabilize the world's climate at any temperature level, we need not to just reduce emissions, we need to cut them all the way to zero. Because if we're adding even just a sliver of the carbon we're producing today, in 50 years, we'll still be heating the planet. That means, I think, that we need to implement these large-scale policy changes. Individuals can help bring that about. In fact, they can even help bring it about through the things they buy and what they how they signal to their friends and loved ones and that kind of thing. But ultimately, the responsibility is a political one rather than a consumption one. And that is to prioritize climate change in your voting, to hold the people who are in office to account, to hold them to the promises they made while campaigning and urge them to make more aggressive pledges, and then hold them to those. And I do think that we are seeing quite dramatic movement there. When I turned in the manuscript of my book in September of 2018, we had never heard of Greta Thunberg. We had never heard of the school strikes. We had never heard of Extinction Rebellion. AOC hadn't been elected to Congress. The Green New Deal was like the name of Jill Stein's climate platform. Now we've been through, just to take the U.S. as an example, we've been through a primary process in which every candidate was competing with the next one to try to be more ambitious on climate. We ended up with the candidate that the climate movement considers impossibly retrograde, Joe Biden. The Sunrise Movement gave him an F on their climate report card. And yet he is many times more ambitious than Hillary Clinton was on climate. And she was many times more ambitious than Barack Obama ever was campaigning. So we're seeing really rapid, and this is from the candidate who the climate movement considered like an impossible lost cause. And he's now got, Jay Inslee working with him. So I think we're seeing quite rapid movement politically. We see it in the public opinion polls too. And we see it all around the world with England declaring a climate emergency, committing to getting to zero carbon by 2050. The governments of Denmark and Finland and Norway saying they're going to do it by 2035 or 2030, which is so fast, I don't even think it's possible, but they're saying they want to do it. So we're seeing an incredible amount of political momentum about this really just over the last year and a half, which is great. The problem is we actually need a lot more movement even than that, because the ambitions, even as stated by these countries, by these leaders in the US, are insufficient as far as science is concerned. But that is one reason why I find that movement so encouraging, because it shows things that were unthinkable 2 years ago are now sort of political centrism. And that means that things that now seem completely impossible to imagine could in just 2 or 3 years' time be totally centrist, middle of the road policies as well. We need that kind of acceleration, but I think the recent past tells us that it is possible, maybe even probable, that we get there.
And that's sort of inspirational, working towards what the IPCC calls transformational change. And it's nice to hear it sort of all wrapped up like that. And again, your elegant usage of time being contracted there, reflecting on the Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, Obama transition there, I think is so sage. So thank you for that. I'd like to pivot. This is just sort of a little factoid question, and I can jump in to help if you'd like. So where are the emissions coming from if economies around the world have shut down, resulting in only a 5 to 8% reduction?
Well, a lot of, industry hasn't gone totally quiet. A lot of the action in China actually throughout the shutdown was industrial. We're still flying a lot of planes. That's not a huge share of global emissions. It's depending on how you count, somewhere between 2 and 5%. But we basically haven't cut the number of flights that we're flying at all, even though the number of passengers has fallen dramatically. And a lot of other processes like the running of transportation systems, infrastructure, all of that stuff can't just be turned off like a light. But actually, you know, I don't know. There is some like kind of mysterious element to it too, because you think, you know, if you cut, I mean, one way of thinking of it is like, if you cut the world economy by 20% for a single quarter, over the course of a year, that's about a 5 or 6% drop in economic activity. And that's basically what we're expecting is going to happen on emissions. So it may be the case that during this discrete period, when everybody's truly in lockdown, we're seeing a more dramatic reduction in emissions. But over the course of the full year, it'll only, assuming an economic recovery, it'll only play out, you know, in a more limited way. But beyond that, I don't know details. Do you know more?
Yeah, well, I think it speaks to exactly as you were saying, individual actions aren't enough. We know that if everybody in the United States, for example, took every individual action that they possibly could, I think it's only reducing total U.S. emissions by about 40%. To do, David, you spoke a little bit before about our energy infrastructure. We know that our energy infrastructure is quite antiquated. There are potential solutions for how we adjust our electrical grid, not just in how we produce electricity, but how we distribute the grid. But this is another major concern of time here. I think we'd need in the next decade or so to build all of the energy infrastructure that we've built in the United States since World War II if we wanted to move towards properly dispersed microgrids. It's getting a little bit in the weeds, but again, speaking to the need for real government-wide support, federal support for efforts like this. Yes, individual actions matter, perhaps the most important being that we vote on these issues. So we've got time for one last question here, and I guess I'll again take facilitator's prerogative here. I gather that there are many concerned folks on the call that and or advocates and or educators, communicators of all stripes. How would you advise us moving forward when it comes to our climate communication? Some of us choose to employ fear only. Some of us maybe only a dosage of it. In my own work, we try to specifically avoid what we call that doom and gloom language, though I don't believe that it doesn't have a role in the conversation. So how would you recommend for those of us on the call move forward with lessons that you've learned?
Well, my big perspective is that the story is too big to tell in any one way, and that everyone should feel invited, even obligated, to talk about it as they respond to the crisis. And that doesn't just mean different strategies for different people. It also often means different rhetorical approaches at different days or different times. You know, there are times when I feel quite distressed, dejected. There are times when I feel terrified. There are also times when I feel moved by the sort of poetic majesty of the transformation of the planet. There are times when I feel exhilarated by what's possible. There are times when I'm focused on the plight of individual families or communities. And there are times when I'm thinking about, you know, the long span of human history. And I think there's a place for all of that kind of all of those different kinds of storytelling and rhetorical approaches, and that people shouldn't feel like there was only one way to do it. In fact, they'll be much more effective if they adopt a kind of diverse portfolio, so to speak. But for me, you know, there are a couple things that I think have been really under utilized. From, you know, by people who are trying to move mountains on this. The first is public health. I think that this has been a relatively small part of climate messaging for a very long time. But I think it's a really powerful prompt when people understand that particularly air pollution affects them in as dramatic ways as it does. And it's incredible. It affects every aspect of physical health, mental health, social health. You know, the little story I like to tell that always blows my mind the most is that the pollution from cars is so powerful that when they introduced Easy Pass in the U.S., it meant that, you know, cars drove right through the toll and they didn't slow down, which meant that they produced a little bit less cost in that area. And in those neighborhoods outside of the Easy Pass, rates of premature birth and low birth weight went down by 11% and 13% respectively. Wow. It has an effect on cognitive performance. It has effect on mental health. It has effect on autism and ADHD and depression and schizophrenia. every aspect. It's like what we've recently learned lead does to us, like, and how important lead was to so many of the social ills of the 20th century. Air pollution, we're now learning, is just as impactful. And it is an incredibly powerful appeal. Polls show it's like clean air is like the most popular thing that any politician could ever run on. And it also solves this riddle, this kind of complicated problem of climate change, which is that the benefits of decarbonization are distributed globally. If everybody in Philadelphia or everybody in the US immediately decarbonized, those residents would only see a tiny fraction of the benefits of that decarbonization. The rest of the world would enjoy it. And the burden of decarbonizing is local. That calculus has changed a little in recent years as economists have started to see the real benefits of investment in green infrastructure. They say now we'll all be better off if we invest more quickly. But nevertheless, it's a sort of intuitive way of thinking about the challenge. And oftentimes, I think governments in particular, but individuals too, are reluctant to embrace really radical policies because they know that the benefits are being distributed globally. The benefits of decarbonizing from a public health perspective are incredibly local. If you close a coal plant, that part of that state is going to be much healthier. The people are going to be much happier. They're going to live longer. The kids are going to be healthier. They're going to do better in school. Absolutely every aspect of human flourishing will be improved by that measure. And it's concentrated locally, so it is a really, really politically potent set of messages. In fact, it pays for itself really, really quickly. There was a study that came out maybe 6 months ago now about the city of Chicago introducing just 2 electric buses into its fleet, just 2. And within a single year, those buses had saved the city $100,000 in health public health expenditure. Now, $100,000 is not an enormous amount when it comes to the budget of the city of Chicago, but it means that functionally, it paid for those 2 buses in the first year. So there's that kind of argument to make, which I think we don't make nearly enough. And then the second thing is related. We've sort of let the conversation around costs and benefits be dominated by opponents of climate change. Mm-hmm. And so that we talk in moral terms and find ourselves arguing with people who present themselves and are seen by the public as having a kind of harder dollars and cents perspective on the issue. The truth is, when you do that math, the benefits of radical decarbonization are very clear, even in the sort of medium term, like over the next decade. And I think that we need to start thinking about, we kind of need to reclaim that that perspective, or that high ground isn't the right word, because it's not exactly high, but we need to like be able to use that tool in our argumentation too, so that we're not just saying we have to do this because of the better angels of our nature. We can say, even if you accept the premises that we need to have this pay for itself and have this be beneficial in the kind of GDP measurable way, in fact, the argument is just as strong using that logic than using the kind of moral humanitarian one, which you and I might feel more compelled by. There are people who feel differently, and ideally we can persuade those people too.
Yeah, thank you, David. So just to recap there, the top 2 takeaways, leaning into health effects, particularly air pollution you mentioned, and those financial benefits of going green, shall we say. So thank you for a rich discussion, and I think that we'll invite back Andy from the Free Library now.
Yes, thank you both so much for the discussion. It was much more hopeful than I had anticipated, honestly. So to our viewers at home, be sure to follow us on Crowdcast and visit us online at freelibrary.org/author-events to access our digital archives and updated event schedule. Thanks again. Keep reading. Have a good night. David, Rachel, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks to all of you.
All right.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.